everyone. I'm Gary Nall, and this is the Progressive Commentary Hour. Today, the theme, propaganda versus truth. Right now, look at all the things that we're being told about Afghanistan, COVID, historically 9/11, Benghazi, the war in Libya, the attacks in Syria, regime changes all over the world. And almost always, the media is completely complicit with the government and corporate interest in giving us propaganda. The average person goes right along with it because that's what they believe, they trust. For those who do their homework and look deeper, no, they stop and say, hold on, I don't like being manipulated and lied to for some ideological or profit motive. So we're bringing in, from United Kingdom, Dr. Piers Robinson, one of the world's leading authorities on propaganda, to discuss these issues.
Good to be with you.
A couple of decades ago, you were investigating political propaganda and how it is framed and communicated by government agencies, as well as the mainstream media. And this has included the narrative behind 9/11, getting the public behind the Iraq invasion to al-Saddam Hussein, the Syrian war, and the White Helmets. And of course, in between all this, we had Libya. And we had a Secretary of State, Hillary Clinton, who cackled about we came and then he died. And I didn't find anything funny about it. I was very disappointed that there was no sense of looking back at what we had achieved, NATO had achieved, but America was really behind it, and Britain, etc., and what we did to a country that was the most flourishing country, one of the most stable countries, one of the most prosperous, and certainly the best educated country in Africa, irrespective of what you might think about Gaddafi. And look at it now, and look at it ever since. No one's apologized. No one in the media said we got that story wrong. No one is, not the New York Times, CNN, none of the major professors who supported this were the talking heads. No one said that anything we have done was wrong on any of these activities. So when you look at the events themselves, then we have the perspective of hindsight, and still no one sees that this is a pattern of behavior that we shouldn't be engaging in, and the media is the media is the propaganda machine. Could you address this in the larger sense, please?
Sure. I mean, my initial academic work and research was into what, as you referred to, the CNN effect. And it was a debate in the 1990s, and it was the notion of the media having become more powerful following the end of the Cold War, and that it was driving intervention during these so-called humanitarian crises. So you had the interventions in Somalia and Bosnia and also northern Iraq following Gulf War, the first Gulf War. And the debate which I started researching was really was this very much to do with the media's role in relation to foreign policy formulation. My initial work came out really sort of around the time of 9/11. I started publishing in 1999. In a sense, the sort of geopolitical context for me as a student studying these issues suddenly changed with 9/11. And we then embarked upon what has now become 20 years of very obvious over warfare being conducted by the West. And one of the sort of journeys I went through as an academic in this is actually starting to realize that a lot of the academic focus on the role of the media and foreign policy formulation was actually missing out a much deeper level and bigger picture in relation to propaganda, in relation to the way in which information was being manipulated by powerful actors, even before the mainstream media became involved and then, as it were, relayed that propaganda. And it was really sort of, it was by 2010 before I really started to appreciate the scale of propaganda in the West. And this very much came about because of my own investigations into the run-up to the invasion of Iraq in 2003 and analysis of a lot of leaked documents, but also published official documents, which had come out as part of inquiries into the Iraq invasion, which actually started to reveal, in a sense, the range of actors in government involved in propaganda, and also revealed how organized they were. And so one of the, I think, the real wake-up moments for me, and this is leading to answer to your question, was when I realized that the notorious September dossier published by the British government, which claimed that Iraq could launch weapons of mass destruction within 45 minutes, that this dossier had actually been in planning since shortly after 9/11 had occurred. That was the earliest sort of indicator you could have of a dossier being planned, so, you know, several years before the actual run-up to the invasion of Iraq. And what that told me was really quite how coordinated and how deliberate and how long-term the planning was in relation to managing public perceptions. Of course, they don't call it propaganda in government. They call it other things, such as strategic communication or perception management was an early phrase from the Pentagon, I think, after 9/11. And that taught me, or that sort of showed me the depth and the range and the level of planning that went on into these activities. And then at that point, you suddenly realize quite how important these are, that governments are not constantly reacting and being pushed to do things, as the CNN effect debate suggested that I'd researched in when doing my PhD, that actually there was far more control and influence than I had realized, and that a lot of academics realized within the fields of political communication. And with that awareness, that led me on down the path of examining propaganda and all of the areas that you mentioned in the introduction that you provided. But what it does tell us, and particularly in relation to the last 20 years of war, is that it indicates, or it shows us, enables us to understand ultimately the level of deception that has been employed over the last 20 years. It enables one to understand the level of manipulation that is going on in terms of managing public opinion and managing people's perceptions of what is going on. And, of course, realizing that is one of the ways of helping to understand exactly what you said, is that despite 20 years of war, despite all of the events that we've seen, we seem to have a political class which is running through the same arguments, continues to assume that the West has benign intentions in the international system. The promotion of intervention in countries is still very strong. You see it in the ongoing conflict in Syria. You can see it in some of the debates circulating around Afghanistan. And in a way, this is remarkable, as you pointed out. How can it be that we're so far down the line with so many wars in the last 20 years flowing out of 9/11? How can lessons not have been learned? How can it not be simply obvious that these wars are wrong, unjustified, and that there are other agendas pushing these wars? And of course, the answer is that the propaganda and the level of propaganda is very extensive. And what we sort of, you know, most people or many people understand this as us as living in democratic societies where there's freedom of information and good levels of understanding, in reality, there's a very high level of propaganda and there's a very high level of manipulation. And people really do not know the full extent of what's going on, certainly in terms of international politics, but also across domestic issues as well. And that's the problem we have. And that's why I'm so sort of focused on the study of propaganda, because ultimately it is a huge problem for our democracies. Obviously, we're not in a democratic society when people are being propagandized at very high levels. People aren't able to make informed choices to understand what's going on. So it becomes critical to the question of democracy to address and challenge the level of propaganda that we have today.
I appreciate your overview. I'm going to hit on a series of issues, and if you could give us your overview on each issue to separate out what we were told officially from government and from the media, and then what would later be found by scholars, investigators, even revealed by whistleblowers, and why no one in the media, no one in government, no one in our departments, including our inspector generals, chose to use any of that information to correct the record, because it would have changed perception of who to trust. I'll go through these one by one, and let's see what your statements and your research has shown versus the official record. And we're going to save COVID for the end, for the last question, because there's so many contradictions between what the actual science is showing versus what the official opinion is. But I'll simply say this about COVID. Throughout my career as an investigative journalist and reporter, as a scientist and a broadcaster, I don't come at anything politically. I never share politics or propaganda. I just look, what are the facts? It doesn't matter who's getting me the facts. I just care about the facts. Then people can make up their mind what they want to do with them from there. But when it came to COVID, for the first time, the orthodox pro-vaccine, pro-mainstream medicine group of physicians and scientists are the leading voices challenging and frequently condemning the official position of Anthony Fauci and Bill Gates and all the other titled agencies, including the World Health Organization. We've never seen this. We are now looking at somewhere close to 100,000 medical doctors and scientists. Over 70,000 have signed the Great Barrington Proclamation. That was a challenge by a professor at Harvard, professor at Oxford, and professor at Stanford University to say, what you're telling us about the COVID pandemic and how to approach it is wrong. And anyhow, they're not challenging that there's a virus that kills people and we should be very cautious and take appropriate measures. They're saying that the measures we've been told to take are wrong, and they believe that about 80% of all deaths could have been prevented and we could have gotten through this, but because of special ideologies and politics and profiteering, we haven't. And so unlike 9/11, unlike invasion of Iraq, unlike invasion of Syria, there we had some of the academics and some whistleblowers, but we didn't have a large number. But now we do. We're talking about enormous amounts of people in the front line who are fighting for patients and treating patients in ways that are saving their lives using orthodox methods, but not using the official wait for the vaccine and get this extremely toxic and worthless drug that they've been promoting. So that in itself is rather a unique phenomenon. That's why I want to save that discussion for last. But let's go through just a few that people will be aware of. 9/11. Then from there, let's take a look at 2003, weapons of mass destruction, and the evidence that existed to show that the official version could easily have been challenged by anybody in the media or even members of Congress had they chosen to, but no one chose to. Then Libya is a good example. The white helmets are another good example. And also, all four of those had something in common. Not only did the official version dominate, but anyone who challenged it was now considered an enemy of the state, and they went after those people. Julian Assange is just one example. Chelsea Manning's another. But you didn't have to be a whistleblower to have your reputation attacked, and Wikipedia was the bulldog that was doing the attacking. And again, the media never criticized Wikipedia and its extreme biases. So could you take us through just those to give us an example of how we should be unpacking the story to see who's got the truth on their side? The forum is yours.
Well, in relation to 9/11, what is very clear now is that the official story has multiple gaps and errors. And one of the strongest indicators of this, I think, as has come in recent years, is there's been extensive research by Professor Halsey at Alaska Fairbanks University, where he's carried out a very detailed investigation of WTC-7, the third building which collapsed on 9/11. And he has concluded very clearly that the NIST investigation of that building collapse is incorrect, that it could not have fallen in the way that the US government is claiming. And really, as soon as that sort of scientific issue is unpacked and understood, then a whole series, raft of questions emerge about 9/11. Questions are inevitably raised about the involvement of state actors in the event. And certainly, I mean, my public position for a number of years has been that that the official story simply isn't tenable anymore. Now, some people argue extensively that, for example, Saudi Arabia has government-level involvement in what occurred. Other people argue that other governments close to home are involved in 9/11, or elements within countries were involved in 9/11. The actual sort of the amount of evidence gathered over the years, I think, from independent researchers, but also academics who focus on this, is pretty compelling now that the official story is incorrect. Where that then leads is a question which I and a number of other academics are involved in looking at as part of a working group. But I suspect that they lead to very dark places in terms of understanding the groups and the entities involved in facilitating, enabling, etc., what occurred on 9/11. But what is certainly true, and I think the sort of the scientific engineering and analysis in relation to the building's collapse, which indicates that they did not collapse in the way the US government said, is pretty strong grounds enough to start to raise fundamental questions, not sort of nitpicking questions over details of the historical narrative, but fundamental questions about what was going on with this event. And I mean that there is a large amount of scholarship out there, and also commentary over the last 20 years, which gives a fairly good picture, I think, for people to see quite how problematic the official story is. And I think that in time, there is an opportunity, I think, to properly establish the truth behind 9/11. I think that the Halsey study and WTC-7, there's an excellent film out at the moment called 7, which is available on Amazon, which details some of the engineering analysis in relation to that. I think all of those developments and then work by, for example, the architects and engineers who have been campaigning about this, the lawyers committee on 9/11 truth, all of these elements, I think, will come together now and in the coming years to allow for a fuller academic and public debate about what happened on 9/11. The other fascinating thing about 9/11, coming from an academic point of view, is the way in which questioning has been sort of silenced right from the beginning. So anybody, as you hinted at, anybody speaking out or raising questions is very rapidly smeared and so on. And that was certainly my experience and has been my experience with mainstream academia. There's a reluctance and a timidity to ask very obvious questions about the event, primarily, I guess, because academics are scared of being accused of being conspiracy theorists or accused even more seriously of being, as it were, enemies of the state, as you hinted at. And I think a number of things come together which have closed down debate. But that's very obvious when you look at the facts and the evidence now. You have these huge gaping holes in the official story, etc. And then you have academics not asking the obvious questions and so on. And I think that's the reality of 9/11, that the official story is not tenable. Inquiry has been going on, and many people do realize that there is a different story to what actually happened on that event. But it's been a very difficult and it's a path for people who've been raising the questions and taken a very long time, I think, to reach the point where we are today, when you have a very detailed, very authoritative study by an engineering department at Alaska Fairbanks University reaching some very far-reaching conclusions about the causes of one of the building collapses in New York, which opens up a can of worms, really. But it has been achieved, and we've gotten to that point now. So I think there's an academic and potentially political and public inquiry will carry on and develop in the coming years. And that's, I think, is reasonably clear. Another way of coming in on this with academia and the research that's been done is that there's never been a thorough analysis of the causes or the agents involved within 9/11. You know, the official story was sort of accepted from day one as to what had happened, no questions asked, and the range of debate was bounded sort of in terms of, well, whether intelligence failures, et cetera, and maybe some hints towards involved of, for example, Saudi Arabia in what had occurred, but very, very limited questioning going on. But that hopefully is coming to an end now. I think that's all I'd say on the 9/11 issue, other than for your listeners to direct them to. There's a lot of work out there now that's been produced over the years. David Ray Griffin and Elizabeth Woodworth's 9/11 Unmasked was published a year or so ago, which summarized the details of a very in-depth conference held in, I think, Canada in 2010, running through all of the issues of the official story. Very rigorous, very detailed work, and which people can read up on and so on. So you have questions over 9/11 itself and on what actually was going on and who was involved and so on. And really, I mean, that does come into Iraq. I mean, I'd say before talking about Iraq and weapons of mass destruction, what has become clear and very well documented in the last 5 years is the fact that 9/11 was clearly exploited from almost day one in order to initiate a series of wars in the international system. Now, this was famously as it were, blurted out by Wesley Clark, the former US general, in 2006, where he talked about having spoken to somebody in the Pentagon shortly after 9/11. And he said that there was a rolling program of attacking, I think, 7 countries in 5 years. And Wesley Clark's claims dismissed, actually, at the time, I remember, by one or two of my academic colleagues as well. It's just that's the conspiracy theory, or he's not telling the truth. The Chilcot inquiry in the UK into the UK's involvement in the invasion of Iraq released some stunning documents, which I wrote about in my own research. And this didn't come out until 2016, 2017, I think, was the year. But these documents actually showed, the communications between Tony Blair, then British Prime Minister, and George Bush, the US President, actually talking about, for example, when to hit Syria, Iran, and Iraq following 9/11, talking about phases 1 and 2 of the war on terror. And a number of other documents came out also sort of showing, for example, I think it was a UK embassy star saying, well, the neocons are saying in Washington, we've now got the opportunity to essentially to initiate conflicts against countries that have got nothing to do with 9/11, but it's an opportunity to use the war on terror threat or claimed war on terror threat, terrorism threat, in order to do some heavy lifting in the international system. And so what these documents really, I mean, they confirmed what Wesley Clark was saying, but also, you know, they confirmed that at the very, very least, following 9/11, the conflicts which were being pursued were not really so much about fighting terrorism as was being claimed. It was about attacking countries and taking out countries who were not fitting in with our agenda or who were not on side with us. And of course, this is just what we've seen over the last 20 years. We've seen these rolling conflicts: Afghanistan, Iraq, Syria, Libya, and so on. And this is all flowed out of these planning documents that you can see from immediately after 9/11. So at the very least, it was clear, you know, it's beyond doubt, whatever one might think about the authorship of 9/11 itself or which entities were involved in that, it was very, very clear that the US and the British governments, at the very least, were using this as a propaganda opportunity to sell wars. And of course, this is where Iraq comes in very clearly. The weapons of mass destruction was a narrative which was built in order to justify invasion. Also, of course, 9/11 was linked to Saddam Hussein very inaccurately by US officials. So they had this kind of dual rationale being promoted, propaganda being pushed out about Iraqi WMD and also suggested links with 9/11. That there were no links with 9/11 between Iraq and so on, but that was promoted. Particularly in Europe and the UK, they promoted the idea that there were weapons of mass destruction in Iraq, that it had current programs. And as we know now, and I've spent a lot of time researching this and publishing on this, the intelligence was manipulated in order to suggest Iraq was had a current ongoing weapons of mass destruction program. So they were just manipulating, distorting the intelligence in order to promote war. And in some ways, this has become a very well known publicly, I think, or at least in the immediate years after the invasion of Iraq, that the intelligence had been over-egged or there'd been a deception as well. But over time, I wonder how much that's sort of been forgotten by a lot of people. I also think academia itself in general has not spent an awful lot of time analyzing that deception, that foreign policy deception, for the reasons I sort of pointed out earlier, is that a lot of academics, mainstream academics, fight shy of areas which are perceived as too controversial. Iraq, invasion of Iraq, very much off the back of 9/11 and then promoted through the narrative of weapons of mass destruction in particular, which was untrue, which was inaccurate. There were no weapons of mass destruction in Iraq which weren't simply leftovers from a very long time ago. There was no current program in Iraq. And then moving to Syria and the conflict in Syria 2011 onwards, and this is an area which I've been researching extensively for some time now. But in Syria, what we have is one component, I think, of what has flowed out of 9/11 and the regime change agenda that we saw, as it were, crystallizing at that point. And in Syria, one of the major deceptions, I think, that we're looking at now, and I think the evidence is becoming very strong on this, is that the allegations of chemical weapon use being leveled against the Syrian government are inaccurate. For example, in the case of the alleged Douma attack in 2018, we now know from leaks from OPCW scientists and others within the organization, and also testimony from OPCW whistleblowers, that the investigation of Douma was manipulated. And certainly from an objective viewing, it seems fairly clear that chemical weapon attack was staged or put together by opposition groups, not the Syrian government. And that's generated a degree of controversy, and the Organization for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons has been caught up in that controversy. But what you can start to see now in Syria and in between Douma in 2018 and the fairly well-known Ghouta sarin attack in 2013 is that the official claims being made by Western governments and some international organizations that the Syrian government is responsible for these attacks is, in fact, inaccurate. And that's certainly where my research has taken me. And we seem to have, in a way, Iraq WMD all over again, except this time there's actual staging and use of these weapons as part of false flag events in Syria. And that seems to be what's coming together in terms of the body of evidence emerging from that conflict. So again, we have, as John Mearsheimer described in his 2010 book, we have the use of deception as a tool of foreign policy. You have, as part of the war on terror, you have deceptions over 9/11 and what happened on that day. You have deceptions over WMD in Iraq. You have deception over Syrian government use of chemical weapons in order to promote and underpin foreign policy objectives. It's deception. There's no other way of describing it. And to achieve that deception, very high levels of propaganda have been used. And I think in stepping back for a second, looking at the broad reality of Western foreign policy, especially for the last 20 years, but one can argue this goes back much, much further, obviously, right to the beginnings of the Cold War, back to the 50s and so on. But you certainly have a situation where multiple wars have been initiated and fought by, led by the US, and some people describe it as also US imperialism, but these wars have been fought and promoted, and deception and propaganda have enabled them. People have supported going into Afghanistan because they thought this is part of a war on terror when it's not really to do with fighting terrorists. People have been pushed or persuaded into supporting invading Iraq because they think there's a weapons of mass destruction threat, and there wasn't one. And with Syria, a lot of the narrative on Syria is underpinned by demonization of the Syrian government through the chemical weapons narrative. Again, what I think is fairly clear is a deception that's been going on. So you have foreign policy pursued through deception. And as John Mearsheimer eloquently describes in his book, Why Leaders Lie, he says that often liberal democracies have to engage in deception in foreign policy because they can't tell the truth to their publics about why they are fighting the wars they are fighting. They have to create sort of stories, sometimes feel-good stories of humanitarian intervention to justify what's going on. But you know, deception is a necessary part, or seen as a necessary part of underpinning wars conducted by democracies. And that's certainly, unfortunately, unfortunately for us in the West, who in a sense carry some responsibility for what our governments have been doing for 20 years, that's the unfortunate reality of where we are. You ask, why does the media go along with this? Well, I don't think it's very well established within the critical political communication literature that the mainstream media is very closely located to political power. The classic articulation of this is Noam Chomsky and Edward Herman's Manufacturing Consent, which itself was really a pulling together of a range of arguments, well evidenced from the literature, which showed that journalists, mainstream journalists, are far closer to political power, far more in bed with political and economic power than the liberal claim that they're independent, etc. When you understand the realities of mainstream media and how they operate, then it becomes easy to understand why they're not pressing, they're not getting the truth out, they're not asking the difficult questions in relation to these foreign policy issues. Journalists fall into line, and especially so in wartime, especially in relation to conflict and matters of national security. It's not right, but that is how they've historically behaved and how they continue to behave today. But of course, that is one of the principal reasons why these wars have carried on so long and why these wars have occurred, because journalists have ultimately failed to do their jobs. But I would always add that it's not just journalists. It's also a lot of academics fail to do their jobs as well. They fail to ask the tough questions. They avoid subjects, for example, the war on Syria, which are seen as too controversial because they don't want to be attacked in public. And so the truth evades us and evades the public mind in relation to these conflicts. Did you want me to carry on right now and talk about COVID, or did you want to just maybe come in on some of that?
I want to go in more depth on the white helmets.
Okay, the white helmets is a component of the Syrian war. For those of your listeners who aren't familiar with the issue. But the white helmets are part of, broadly speaking, they're part of Western-funded groups within Syria, which have been part of the drive to overthrow the Syrian government. Now, the White Helmets were set up by a former US, a former British military officer, James LeMessurier, and they were set up as a first responder rescue organization, which was there to try to save people and so on. And this is the way, of course, the White Helmets is presented in a lot of the mainstream media in the West. What is also clear, and the criticism of the White Helmets, is that they're not independent of the belligerent groups in Syria. Many people, for example, Vanessa Beely, Eva Bartlett, have argued that they're very closely associated with some of the extremist groups that the West has ended up backing in Syria. And certainly from the case of the documents which have slowly come out over the time, it's clear that, for example, I know one British government document talked about recognising the importance of the White Helmets in terms of highlighting and presenting events in Syria. Of course, they wouldn't claim that it was doing that inaccurately, but the reality is presenting images, presenting a story, a narrative of what's occurring in Syria, which is conducive to Western interests, has been part of the output of the White Helmets. I mean, your listeners can look at the work of, as I said before, Vanessa Beely or Eva Bartlett and see some of the deeper level controversies about the way they operate and so on. But the most generous reading that one can give is that the White Helmets set up and supported by the UK government and other Western governments is part of trying to present Western involvement in that war in the most positive light possible, and in a sense, almost trying to put a kind of a nice window dressing on the reality of the war in Syria, which is that there's been extensive involvement from US, France, UK, Qatar, Saudi Arabia, also Israel, trying to overthrow the Syrian government. And this has been going on since, as far as I can tell, really from the very beginning. Very famously, and perhaps not so famously, because it's not really publicly known, but this is known, Operation Timber Sycamore was a CIA Saudi operation which was supporting extremist groups trying to overthrow the Syrian government. And in the broadest sense, whatever is occurring within Syria in between the Syrian government and groups opposed to the Syrian government, and that's all I'll say on that, whatever the reality of that, the big picture with the Syrian conflict is the fact that Western governments have been trying to and working extremely hard to overthrow the Syrian government. And as part of doing that, many Western governments and also allies in the region, Turkey, Saudi Arabia, have ended up supporting groups. I think, as Tulsi Gabbard was pointing out a couple of years ago, are Al-Qaeda-linked group, extremist groups, and so on. So the White Helmets, in a way, I think, has presentationally become a way of trying to effectively gloss over that deeper reality of what Western governments have been trying to do in Syria. And again, without, and I'll come to some of the specific criticisms of the White Helmets in a minute, but before even making any judgment over what they're actually doing or not doing within Syria, what this kind of, you know, window dressing or icing on the cake of the foreign policy is achieving ultimately is that it's actually obscuring a very important truth to the war in Syria. It's a 10-year-long war. And that very important truth is that the US and UK and France, and I'm a British citizen, and many of our allies have been involved in an entirely illegal regime change operation. You know, these are not legal things, that governments are allowed to do. And it disguises that. And of course, in the broader picture, it helps maintain this impression that the West isn't really particularly involved in the conflict. We support the White Helmets who rescue people, so the Western governments claim, but we're not really involved in any other way. And that's another lie. We're extensively involved in trying to overthrow the Syrian government. And that continues today. I mean, as you probably know, a third of Syria is occupied by groups supported by America. It's in the oil field territories. Turkey still occupies Idlib, and there's now a very brutal sanctions regime leveled against the Syrian government, which is continuing the suffering of the Syrian people. all of these ugly realities of the war are kind of pasted over by sort of things such as the white helmets presenting this sort of very sort of clean, where they're trying to save lives or support the saving of lives and so on. And so that's kind of deception at that level. What my own research, my own involvement with the controversy over the alleged chemical weapon attack in Douma in 2018, the one where we've had documents leaked from the OPCW and OPCW persons speaking out about manipulation of their investigation of what happened there, is what we do know is that the White Helmets were very much involved in the events surrounding Douma. And because the balance of evidence now is clearly pointing in the direction, is my assessment of the evidence, that this was a staged event, then it's clearly a staged event which has occurred with the participation of the White Helmets in some shape or form. I say in some shape or form, but, you know, that they were very closely involved. They were very closely involved in sort of talking to the OPCW, telling them what had happened in Douma, allegedly. They also appear to have been involved in the removal and burial of victims of the alleged attack, which raises some very serious questions. So one of the more focused criticisms of the White Helmets is that, you know, even if elements of the White Helmets are involved in doing what the British and American governments claim that they're doing in Syria, there's also appears to be elements in which they're involved in staging of these chemical attacks. And also with essentially managing information going through to international organizations such as the Organization for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons. And certainly some of our research has now shown this fairly clearly, evidence, some of that evidence being inaccurate or distorted. So you can see the picture emerging here. You have these entities funded on the ground, funded by Western governments, set up by former British military officers, involved in passing up information, which then helps build the narrative being promoted by Western governments that the Syrian government is systematically using chemical weapons in Syria. And that's the, in terms of my own area of research, that's the picture which is emerging. And as we go on, you know, the White Helmets, and I'm sort of just writing some pieces at the moment on this, but the White Helmets and from leaked documents we've seen in the last year, the propaganda or stratcom operations being funded by Western governments in Syria have been huge. And there's a big leak of documents from a year ago. And very sort of briefly, but what it shows to people is that you have a whole range of what appear to be non-governmental organizations, private entities, essentially involved in the strategic communications operations. You see this with the White Helmets, and they were funded through an NGO called Mayday Rescue. You see this in IncoStrat, which was a private company set up by, again, a former British military guy, which then provided PR operations for, I think, Jaish al-Islam and other opposition groups in Syria. And what you have is you have this network of contracted out Stratcom operations to private companies, often being led, being run by former military officers. And that, I think, is one of the realities of the contemporary propaganda environment, is that, say, with the Iraq invasion of Iraq, a lot of the propaganda was, you know, coming from the intelligence services and coming through formal channels. In the war in Syria, we've seen this kind of dramatic contracting out of propaganda and stratcom operations. And the White Helmets are, I think it's reasonable to say that they are clearly part of that. And whatever the reality might be of if they're doing good or not, or if some of them are doing good or not doing good, they're clearly part of that broader narrative building that we've been seeing going on in Syria, which has ultimately disguised the reality of Western regime change attempts within the country.
I appreciate that insight. Thank you. I want to go to COVID in a moment, but very briefly. Right now, we're seeing a major catastrophe in Afghanistan, and yet the propaganda is, the president said, that everything they did was fine. They made no mistakes at all. Well, how about the mistake of allowing the military-industrial complex to dictate virtually all of our foreign policy when it comes to regime changes, including in Afghanistan? How about the fact the media and the White House made it seem as if the justification for going into Afghanistan was that the Taliban was responsible for 9/11? Can you inform me which Taliban were responsible for 9/11? I believe that that was the Saudi Arabia that was responsible, and that every president from Bush and Clinton, the Secretary of State, but also Obama and Trump, they all hid that information. The victims actually had to go to court over years to get documentation to show that the planning behind 9/11 substantially was the Saudis. So if they were going to invade a country for retribution, they should have invaded Saudi Arabia, but they didn't. In fact, 88% of Americans believe, both Democrat and Republicans, they supported George Bush's war 3 weeks after the U.S. bombs began raining down on Kabul. And also remember, every member of Congress except one voted for that invasion. And yet we didn't have the proof. The Taliban did not attack us on 9/11. 19 men, 15 from Saudi Arabia did, and there was no imminent threat that Afghanistan would attack the United States or another UN member country, but nobody cared. They had an agenda. All 98 senators present, including Bernie Sanders, voted to bomb Afghanistan and install a puppet regime whose corruption led to what we see today. In the House of Representatives, the vote was 420-1. There was only one person who told the truth, and that was Barbara Lee from California, who said, as a member of the clergy so eloquently said, as we act, let us not become the evil that we deplore. So when we take a look at Afghanistan and we see the message there, our National Security Agency knew all this was going to happen because they monitor every single communication in the world, and it took months of planning and weeks of strategic analysis in order to coordinate this 14-day drive that virtually took over the entire country and entered Kabul without a single shot needing to be fired. They just walked right in. And interesting, because one of the comments that Biden said recently, he said that, you know, the government is, and the troops, 300,000, the best equipped in the world outside the United States. Now think of that. Now we have just equipped the Taliban as being one of the best equipped in the world. That's actually an exaggeration, but considering the Bagram Air Base, and by the way, all of the communication systems, all the computers, all of the payroll records showing who was being paid what and for what work, all the interpreters, all the special assassins and the hit squads against the Taliban working with the Afghan government, all that in their information, their social security, not their social security, but all their information, where they live, their family members. Now the Taliban's going after these people. Do you think that they're going to be kind to groups of people that were out there killing them and assassinating? And one of the heads, if not the head of the government, spent 13 years in Guantanamo Bay, and also the torture, interrogation. And clearly, he's not going to forget what he went through. How will that impact what he decides will be done with the 10 to 15,000 more or less citizens, American citizens, who are there? This is a mess. And yet the media will, by and large, give him a pass, say what a wonderful job he's done. We needed to do it. It might have been a little messy, you know, but now we're not in that same position. All that is propaganda. I just want to state that. But real quick, do you have any knowledge of the propaganda around Clinton's and the President Obama calling the military not to go into Benghazi, where they could have? That historically has been shown. They could have been there and saved those people because it was being used. The Ambassador Stevens was there to facilitate the Gaddafi's weapons being shipped into Syria from Libya, and that would have been information that they didn't want to let out, so they sacrificed these people. Do you have any knowledge on that?
Yeah, on that particular case, I'm only vaguely familiar with the Benghazi issue, so I wouldn't really want to make any comments on that. I mean, going back to including that, but going back to Afghanistan and your points about how that conflict started, I mean, most of the official narratives are just inaccurate or false. I mean, the idea that Afghanistan was about dealing with 9/11, which, as you say, 9/11 was at least at face value, was hijackers mainly from Saudi Arabia. And the Taliban, of course, were not al-Qaeda. And the Taliban, of course, were saying, if you show the evidence, then we will hand over bin Laden, etc. The official justifications are narratives built to justify, but they're inaccurate. I mean, I think with Afghanistan, as you've had with the whole of the global war on terror, this is geopolitical chess playing and use of force, starting of wars, in order to try to shore up power and project influence. And that's the brute reality of the last 20 years. And the arguments over bringing democracy to Afghanistan, arguments about fighting terrorism and so on, are all part of the window dressing. They're part of the propaganda. And I think that's pretty clear. And, you know, one of the things that I think people need and publics need to fully understand in the West is that the narratives built to explain to them the international world of politics are propaganda, and they're inaccurate, and that what's really going on is power politics. And the sooner that is understood, the better. In terms of what's happening now in Afghanistan, it is unclear to me. I haven't had time to look very closely. There is a transition of power, a passing of power over, and it's not quite clear to me exactly why things have become, you know, so fraught in terms of U.S. personnel being caught. I'd be very wary about making any hard and fast claims at the moment about what exactly is going on and responsibility and so on. The only thing from the last 20 years has taught me is that normally things are not quite as they seem. But for sure, as with all of the other conflicts and as with the war on terror itself and issues surrounding 9/11, the political class, the elite class, is evades responsibility for all of these things. That is one of the central problems we have. And I think, sorry, did you want to come in?
We're running short on time now, but I'd like for you to go over the most important points about the propaganda on COVID. Just hit the high points, please.
Well, on COVID-19, it is very clear from very early on that there was a very high level of censorship being leveled at scientists who were questioning the response. It was very clear that populations were panicking and politicians were introducing very extreme measures, lockdown, to deal with a virus. And that was an immediate indicator that there was propaganda going on, that there's manipulation of information. I think initially some people sort of thought, well, okay, maybe there's an overreaction going on the part of governments. Maybe the fact that they are actually engaging in intentional propaganda is because they're trying to deal with a virus which they think is going to be extremely serious and so on. But over time, and now that we are a year and a half into this now, and the goalposts have been continually moved from we need to lock down for a few weeks to save the hospitals to the vaccine will release you or free us, through to what we now seem to be moving into in Western countries and in Australia, New Zealand, Canada, which is a vaccination of the entire population and more lockdowns are what's being planned and threatened, certainly in European countries, that quite obviously there are other agendas at play, that there are other things being pushed in order to other agendas being pushed under the cover of COVID-19. And it's reached such an extreme point now, we have thousands of people, many or hundreds of thousands of people in countries throughout the West willing to go out onto the streets to demonstrate. As you very accurately pointed out, we have a phenomenal number of scientists who are calling this out, saying that the policies are wrong, this doesn't make any sense. And it is, and you're absolutely right to say that this is, in a sense, very unusual. This is not what we've seen before. And I think what this tells us and what this tells us about the state that we're in, especially in the West, is that we now have a crisis. We have an event, we have COVID-19, which has been propagandized and exploited in order to enact what appear to be a range of societal, political, and economic transformations in the West, being used as cover to move those through, and with very extensive resistance to this now, both from large sections of the public who are willing to go out and protest, from organizations forming, political parties forming, trying to resist this, and then with the sort of, as it were, the mainstream or the extreme center trying to hold the line on this in the face of opposition, in the face of, as you said, many scientists calling out the errors of things such as lockdown, the dangers associated with vaccines, etc. We're in very interesting times and very dangerous times, but I think we are at a point now in history, certainly of the West, where the hollowing out of our institutions, whether it's media or the academia, has become very clear. And we have a very powerful exploitation of an event, COVID-19, for propaganda purposes in order to realize wide-reaching changes in our societies. And there are some great investigative journalists out there writing about this, Cori Morningstar, Whitney Webb, others, and a whole range of organizations who are sort of documenting what's going on at the global level, the World Economic Forum, etc. And these are clearly people with agendas who are trying to push through. And at the moment, vaccine passports, digital ID, digital currency, all the things which seem to be coming down the line very, very fast, and which have major implications, which indicate a substantial, potentially loss of the remaining democracy and freedom that we have in the West, and we really are reaching a very interesting moment, and that's a very polite way of saying we're in very dangerous, very dark times at the moment with what we're seeing around us.
Pierce, thank you very much for being on. We look forward to our next conversation with you.